Hello, and welcome to Real Talk, where curiosity chases truth every Tuesday at noon on KVSH 101.9 FM and on voiceofvashon.org at your convenience. I'm your host, Susan McCabe. Today, we're going to question some sacred ideas about climate change and how to mitigate some of its most devastating effects, like electric vehicles. To help us explore that sacrosanct territory, I've invited Ian Morse, a science and environment journalist with an eye on how business impacts land, oceans, and indigenous rights. He writes The Green Rocks, a newsletter that doesn't want dirty mining to ruin clean energy. He has a particular focus on Indonesia, where he continues to investigate forests and corruption. And that's how he comes to us on Real Talk. He's among the experts who present electric vehicles beyond the carbon question, an event at Open Space for Arts and Community, November 11th. Welcome, Ian.
Hi, Susan. Great to be here.
It's good to have you. And you're coming to us from Seattle, right?
I am, yeah. I'm in Beacon Hill right now.
Ah, well, nice to have you. And it'll be interesting to hear you and the other folks who are going to be here on November 11th. Before we get started on that discussion, tell us a little bit about Green Rocks, your publication.
So Green Rocks is a weekly newsletter. Actually, it's now transitioned to biweekly. But I began it during the pandemic because just before the pandemic, I was in Indonesia researching a lot of these topics and reporting on these topics and writing on these topics. And locked down in the pandemic, I felt I still needed to keep up with these things. So I felt that that was a way to encourage me to keep up with these, to make sure other people could learn about these. And then at the same time, I realized that these topics were beyond just Indonesia, beyond just environmental or traditionally forest reporting. They're also about science. They're also about business and markets and things. So that was a way to bring it all together and help create the idea of mining and climate technology as a focus that that people could pay attention to.
It's complicated.
Yes.
And far-reaching. So let's get to that topic. Electric vehicles have been touted here in the U.S. and abroad as salvation for the planet from the impacts of global warming. How accurate is that?
Well, that's a tough question. Electric vehicles, of course, are better than gas guzzlers. For one, the air pollution that immediately comes from the tailpipe. But also the entire supply chain of oil that travels around the world, releasing emissions wherever it can, and encouraging people to simply burn as much as they can, regardless of the impact. So electric vehicles at least definitely make people think about their energy, make people think about how clean they're being. And certainly for cities, for the air in cities, electric vehicles are better. The focus, from my perspective, well, I guess I started on this topic in Indonesia because a lot of the friends around me were concerned about mines that were popping up around them. And as I began to investigate these, the mines were writing the same promise that electric vehicles were writing, which was, we need to transition our energy, and we need then to create a lot of technologies and products that can do that for us. And those products need a lot of materials. So these mines were popping up in order to provide, at least in this instance, nickel for batteries that would end up in both electric vehicles and stationary storage that could be used for grid storage. So for like wind energy and solar power for the batteries at those plants. So I realized, I think, in answering how accurate, I guess, the electric vehicle promise is, in some sense, everything that comes from someone trying to sell you something should be questioned. It is a marketing promise, and it is definitely something that scientists also realize is necessary, but naturally there's some nuance. If, for example, we were to transition every single vehicle on the road in the world right now, we probably actually wouldn't even have enough material, or at least the access to materials currently, to be able to do that like within this century. That's 1.2, 1.4 billion vehicles in the world.
Wow.
In the US, there's hundreds of millions. And transitioning every single one of those would be difficult. So the electric vehicle promise, perhaps as people have it in their minds as a one-to-one swap, maybe isn't the quickest, the most efficient, the cheapest way to tackle emissions from transportation. So that's the goal is then to explore what could be the other options there.
And what have you found? What are some of the other options?
Well, in speaking with, I guess it depends on your perspective. So scientists who have been researching cities for a long time, they, even before climate promises and climate action became top of the agenda, they linked cars with inequity in cities because it allows people to travel and to move their homes and to create certain pockets of wealth within cities. And it also creates large barriers to people in accessing their jobs or in accessing simply space in the city, because some studies have suggested between a quarter and half of cities are spent just storing cars somewhere.
Wow. Is that because we've not developed public transportation?
Yes. So these same kind of researchers who focus on cars also realize that transportation is valuable, of course, and there are other ways to do transportation. So public transportation, for instance, buses or trains, or even some kind of mix of the two that could include rental cars, that could include sharing vehicles, things like that. Those have been touted not only as tools to increase equity in cities, but also there could be faster ways to address the emissions that come from cities or transportation in cities specifically. And it kind of hits two birds with one stone because it's equity and climate emissions.
And those things all have to be considered at one time. Congress just passed Biden's infrastructure bill, and a good portion of that money supposedly is going toward green vehicles, greening public transportation. What do you know about that, and how do you see that as progress in tandem, perhaps, with the idea of electric vehicles?
Well, I think obviously maybe not obviously, but money that is given to public transportation is usually for the better because it means that it's automatically going to be shared. Naturally, if it's used well and if it's put in the right places, those are two separate questions from that initial point. But the with this most recent bill, I don't know as much about it because there's been a lot of great things that have come out of it from climate, but also it hasn't met a lot of expectations from people who really realize that things need to change and quickly. I think the way that a lot of scientists, a lot of researchers, activists think about rewiring cities, electric grids, transportation, it's going to take a massive overhaul. It's going to take not necessarily on the individual level, because you still will be able to get to your job. You'd still be able to travel to where you want, go hiking on the weekends kind of thing. But cities, particularly in Europe, for example, when they give examples for how they can design cities with increased public transportation, with less reliance on individual vehicle ownership, these cities look, they feel different. They have social impacts that stretch beyond just where your car goes or where vehicles are. They're about relationships between people. They're about how far your grocery store is, how big that grocery store is as well. So when an infrastructure bill comes out like this, $1.2 trillion, I think was the value.
Something like that.
Yeah, I mean, the initial proposition was far higher.
Right.
I think for a lot of people who work in this space, it's kind of unfortunate that the kinds of things that they were expecting were not able to come out of it. And so I know that at COP, this climate conference in Glasgow right now, Biden has been able to say a lot of great things, but at the same time, he has brought nothing from his country to back those things up. Yeah.
You, I mean, I'm looking at you. You're a young man. I'm guessing you're a millennial. And
perhaps, yeah.
Yes. And are you?
I think I just fit within it, yes.
Okay. There are lots of millennials, lots of young folks at Glasgow who are protesting the rhetoric versus action kind of thing. Where do you stand on that? Or how do you see that impacting the actual outcome of COP26?
There's probably a lot of things to say about the kinds of people that are protesting there. My mother actually is there right now, and she sent me a picture, for example, of a Darth Vader or a person in a Darth Vader costume DJing outside where she was living.
Cool.
That is not probably the typical kind of activist at COP, but there are certainly a lot of people, and not only from Europe or the US, but from all over the world, who have gathered there to, I think, to make it clear to people that when we think about public spending, when we think about overhauling systems, they're by nature, they're kind of not going to be felt by the people who are in power right now. And kind of, I say by nature, not only because of the age, but also if they were to continue to be in power, those things may not happen. So I personally think it is, I think as a journalist as well, to see the kind of movement, the kind of activism that has come out of COP and that is going into COP is invigorating, I guess, because the point of these kinds of conferences are to have just a absolutely myriad range of views and possibly the kinds of views that we need to hear right now are not the ones that we already know or that have the power, that have the pedestal. So to have people who are young, I mean, perhaps that includes me, but I wouldn't consider myself within that activist group, I guess. Those people who are young, I mean, they kind of also by nature, they're coming from somewhere that may have some power, but certainly are not locked in a job or not already, I guess, attuned and accustomed to the systems that already exist. They're, I guess, a bit more.
Well, they're not holding the purse strings or the authority over the policies.
Yes,
all they can do is vocalize research and vocalize some more. How do you see the efforts at COP26 reaching those billionaire people who are basically running the show right now, the oil companies and, plastics manufacturers, same group. How do you see COP26 or anything reaching those people? They're the ones who are going to have to change.
Yes. I think they know that they're going to be the ones that have to change. I think that's part of the reason that I think I saw a figure recently that if all of the oil and gas lobbyists at COP right now were to be a country, they would have double the size, the delegation of the next biggest country, which may be the US.
Wow.
Yeah, so there are a lot of people there just from that industry, and it's very clear what they want. And some people, I mean, they have their own goals. They say that they will try to transition their own energy. I guess there's not really, as a journalist, for example, I view my work in terms of power. They already have a lot of power. There are people and ideas that do not have a lot of power, and partly because they don't have a lot of power, we're in this kind of situation where we need to be very urgent about these things. So I am already inclined to say, all right, whatever, do your thing, oil and gas lobbyists. We're going to try to ignore you. Unfortunately, you have a lot of money and you have people under your umbrella. But in order to raise awareness, I'm going to use the people who already don't have a lot of power and have new ideas that we really need.
Awareness is great. Frankly, you might hear this in my voice. I'm starting to get impatient with the notion of, yes, let's raise awareness and let's all try to act accordingly. But if the people in power who are manufacturing things that we are dependent upon, and the people in power who are creating the policies that will or will not allow industry to shift, if they're not doing anything, frankly, what good is awareness?
Yeah, I think part of what we can see from that kind of thing is that awareness really has no power against money, I guess. And if all these new ideas are coming from money, and to some extent, I mean, this is actually kind of the thing that connects these oil and gas lobbyists to these electric vehicle companies, for example. The ideas are coming from money. And if they're trying to sell you something, then automatically there's an incentive there. It's clear what the motivation is. And so it takes a lot of effort, unfortunately, but it also, those avenues are available to access the ideas, the perspectives, and the people who don't have a lot of power, but also really have valid ideas, ways of addressing the climate crisis, ways of taking down companies, but also just ways of living that, and some of these ideas have been around for a long time. I mean, it really sucks that just we haven't devoted a lot of time to taking care of those ideas, listening to these people. So for example, I mean, you mentioned that I focus a lot on indigenous rights. One of the main climate technologies, I put that in quotes, is not like a product that you create in a factory, but it's rather give land rights to people. That is one of the best ways proven to stop emissions, to take care of biodiversity, to also to like increase wealth within those groups. So if we want to think really broad scale about the kinds of tools that we have to address the climate crisis, we can't just think in terms of, or think in the American way, which is if somebody can make a profit from it, then it deserves to exist. Or if somebody can make a profit from it, that is the only way we'll validate that it has value in our society. There are tools, there are ways that motivations that don't involve money and companies that, at least in my mind, mm-hmm. and I'm smiling as I say this, in yes. my mind is are valuable, definitely valuable. Yeah.
In a way, clearly, that for at least for America is a huge cultural shift. And I'll qualify that with, it may be a huge cultural shift among those people who are profiting from oil and gas, from fossil fuels and so forth. It may be a cultural shift that is beginning to bubble up from beneath, which is, or from below, wherever the rest of us are, which may be the positive impact of awareness. In other words, do you think it's possible that raising awareness, that making these protests, that being loud about what has to happen, this is urgent, could actually move some of those powerful people who can make a difference into a sense of urgency? I mean, they're human too. They're going to burn. They're going to drown.
Yeah. I think this is a perennial question. It touches on the idea of whether the responsibility for action is on the individual or the group. It touches on the idea of, I mean, the concept of cultural shifts. Yes, we can say that the climate crisis will require a cultural shift, but also in the past 20 years, we've had several massive cultural shifts in terms of the internet, in terms of the devices in our hands. In terms, I mean, just in the last year, we're speaking over Zoom right now. So these are all cultural shifts. And if we think about it in terms of, oh no, we'll have another cultural shift. Okay, what does that really mean, I guess? And this question also, I mean, it can touch on, yes, like we said, this American way, I guess. I say that especially because just there are other ways of organizing products and markets in societies that don't necessarily depend upon ensuring that a company can profit off of it before it is validated as something that can be a climate tool, for example. So I think these are the kinds of questions that I hope to touch on in this event that'll be on Thursday. Mm-hmm. I think it is my personal perspective that it is very difficult to put a lot of the burden on individuals. I used to have that on myself. I still do, definitely. And it's really hard to deal with to say that we have a responsibility to buy the exact, the right electric vehicle, or to make sure that we devote every excess income toward a activist group that is fighting for public transportation or whatever it is. Those things are very valid. In some sense, they need to happen and they're supportable. At the same time, if people can't do that, or if people find other avenues to have their own show of responsibility, then those things are also valid as well. So the climate crisis did not start because of any one person. It started because of a very select group of people who decided what everyone else needed. And if I think one way to get past that individual responsibility is to say, we don't want to listen to what these companies are telling us anymore. We want to instead say, I realize what you're trying to sell me. I don't think that's the best thing. And my method of protest against you, it's not necessarily to like boycott you or to say that your business is bad, but I will decide for myself. Like, I am now empowered to decide how I would like to design my own life rather than have markets decide it, for example. But another piece that we'll touch on probably in this event is what does collective action look like? And naturally, with all of these topics, I am still a journalist, so I don't know the exact way. I like exploring the different options that people put together. But collective action is messy. It takes a lot of organizing, but it's probably the best way to try to, especially on a local level, achieve action and change. So maybe that answers your question. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it brings up a few more. As a journalist in this field, I'm sure you've been exploring alternative energy companies. And where do you see the most growth happening? In other words, are there businesses that are developing truly helpful alternative energies that are really getting a foothold and might begin to balance out or even take over the fossil fuel industry?
So that's a broad question, of course.
I know,
right?
Of course.
But maybe so in terms of electric vehicles, there's the market example of kind of Tesla's major rival globally, or at least upcoming rival, they're not quite in the same market yet, is BYD. This is a Chinese electric vehicle company, very, very popular in China. If we speak in terms of, say you want to evaluate your electric vehicle battery in terms of how well it can be recycled, Tesla, scientists say, their battery, for example, is extremely difficult to recycle. You basically have to shred it, burn it, and then you only get a sliver of the remaining heaps of black mass out that you can recycle. The rest can go to construction industries or thrown away, or who knows what happens with it, because just the way that the Tesla batteries are designed. Now, BYD, they've recently, as encouraged by some Chinese regulations, they've recently developed a kind of battery where you can, with your hands, go in and just take out a battery cell and replace it with another one. And that battery cell is already, it already clears a huge hurdle that Tesla has not cleared, which is all these glues, all this wiring, you just can't take it apart. And then you can recycle that elsewhere. Now, those batteries, there's a lot of science that, I guess a lot of scientific perspectives that go into how to interpret whether those batteries are better or worse. Tesla, for example, if you want a sports car, you pump in a lot of nickel, manganese, and cobalt, and you can go 0 to 60 as fast as the biggest gas-guzzling car. That's an exaggeration, but it's pretty good. Does everyone need that? Another perspective to consider, does everyone really need a sports car to just go to work in the morning? I mean, it's a whole other question whether you need a car in the first place.
Right, right.
Yeah, but BYD, for example, they have for a long time promoted batteries that use very different kinds of materials and may not get the same kind of range or power, but they're more easily recycled. They're definitely cheaper. They've already cleared a big hurdle that Tesla has yet to clear in terms of price.
Tesla's incredibly expensive, and there other electric vehicles in the American market that are less expensive, but this is really intriguing, this BYD battery. Mm-hmm. So the big question kind of is, should we all go out and buy an electric vehicle if we can afford it? And what will that do to Sulawesi?
So Sulawesi, for listeners, I guess, is this island in Indonesia. This is where I was. This is where also this group on Thursday focuses as well.
The Alliance for Tompatika Alto, yes. Which was originated here on Vashon Island.
Yeah, very neat. A small world.
Yes.
So Sulawesi, this island, it's kind of the epicenter of Indonesia's nickel production. And Indonesia produces the most nickel ore of any country. They basically give it all to China. Philippines is the next one. But it mainly comes from Sulawesi as well as some of the Maluku Islands, if people have heard that name before as well. Now, going out and buying an EV, I can't recommend for or against it because, I mean, it's so complicated. It's really hard to say how certain batteries or certain cars are better than others. It's hard to say like how it works with each individual's lifestyle as well. I think in general, it's worthwhile to put out as much information as possible for people to make their own decisions and then be able to use that information or have government use that information to try to write rules that govern these kinds of businesses and consumption. Because we've never had these kinds of colossal batteries running around on our highways before. And so we don't have rules that govern that. We don't have rules in the US especially that govern recycling of those things. We don't have rules that govern how exactly, this term ethical mining of nickel, cobalt, other ones.
Is there such a thing?
I'm a mining reporter, so I will defer to others to answer that question.
I see, okay.
But people are just now trying to create what does like clean, quote unquote, clean cobalt or nickel or lithium look like? It's a very messy question, as probably listeners can understand. It's also not one that's being determined right now by people who don't have vested interests. So there are consumers are not determining this thing unless it comes out through public pressure. Government is not determining this, but it's industry people, and these are consultants who are also paid by the industry to determine, is this a good mine? Are we allowed to put this into our batteries? And then the motivation there is more often than not whether public pressure will respond poorly to this rather than whether it actually has impacts in the field. Now, those systems have never been created before. In the world, like there's no precedent for a product that makes it halfway around the world in a completely different form and then also traverses the world again or whatever. Having that determine what happens at the source. This kind of extractive nature of global markets is only a few hundred years old. And as probably listeners can also imagine, there hasn't really been the same kind of knowledge about the sources of these materials. And where there has been, it's been mainly for exploitation. And it's the kinds of systems that have led to the climate crisis, things like colonialism, imperialism, and destructive capitalism, things like that. So those things have not been written yet. They are trying to be written, and they're definitely on people's minds, but it's not necessarily, there are vested interests, naturally.
Right, and then the foxes are watching the chicken coop at the moment.
Yes.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if we can go beyond electric vehicles. If mm-hmm. right now we were trying to reduce our carbon emissions, are there people who are looking at alternative fuels like biodiesel, or are there people who are looking at ways to convert internal combustion engines that exist now to batteries? Like, I can't afford to go out and buy an electric vehicle. I have a tiny little car, Fiat, that burns gas. And I can't afford to go out and buy a new car. But could I somehow convert my car to biodiesel, or could I somehow, which might be less polluting, and I'm not totally confident it is, or could I convert it to a battery operated vehicle? In other words, is anybody that you know of looking at that sort of thing?
So the kind of like makeshift do it in your own home, I guess DIY, convert your own car or other machinations into less, carbon emitting or something like that, is super difficult, because there's even the regulations that exist for companies to manage these things don't quite cover all the safety. So there have been issues, I guess I can just say, with people trying to do that at their own homes. I think the way I think about it is much more broadly, that not only is it a question about what kind of car you should have, but rather like how you should consider your use of energy in general, or your need to travel across the state every week or something like that, whatever it is for any lifestyle. And I realize I'm not trying to put the burden of fixing someone's lifestyle on everyone. I'm trying to instead to say, there's a lot of other things to consider. There's, if at one point you want to put a battery or some big battery in your own car, however that may work, usually it requires different engines, so it may be pretty difficult. What if instead at the same time you consider, okay, what do you need that car for? Okay, I need it for groceries. Okay, where's the grocery store? Okay, over there. If it's far, is there ways to actually build community around yourself and share a car? Is there a way to carpool to places? Is there, is the bus trustworthy? Can you just take the bus somewhere? Can you go shopping more than once a week so that you don't have to carry as many bags and you could easily walk it or something like that? But these are questions also that are, these are answers that are very difficult, because it may end up being that your grocery store is just way too far for you to ever consider going there more than once a week or trying to walk there.
Yeah, that's true in suburbia. Now,
yes. But those, I guess, in the reverse as well, the reason your grocery store is so far is because the city relies on so many cars. Is because like the customers for that grocery store come from all around and they have to stock it full. They have to buy a huge building for all these people who are coming in from across the lake or whatever it is. That's a difficult answer, because it's really hard to change that kind of thing. But it's something to consider in assessing your surroundings. How many of your things are around you are created by your own energy consumption? And that could be your car. That could be how often you use electricity. For instance, in the U.S., I believe now I may cite this statistic incorrectly, but effectively, as probably listeners would know as well, U.S. consumption of energy is higher than per capita, is higher than any other country, and it's vastly, vastly higher than the next one, the next in line, which is the EU, effectively. And there's a lot of answers for that. It could just be the averages are swayed by billionaires. It may also be that we fly a lot, that we drive a lot, that our food comes from all over the world rather than next door.
So it's
a odd question.
It is about considering as an individual where you live, how you live, the proximity of your necessities to your home, those kinds of things, how you travel, if you travel. And those, I hope, can make a difference if people really begin to think, as they move through a day, how am I using energy? How am I planning my trips? How am I using water? That's another whole subject.
I think in a way, unfortunately, a lot of these barriers to lower consumption, lower energy consumption, are going to be, like, they feel like they're on the individual, but they're going to be, need to be collective action, because the way that you reduce energy is you make friends and you carpool, or you find someone close by and make friends with the, we have a bodega down the street. And we try to go there, walk there as often as we can. But things like that, I think there are new advantages to those kinds of changes. And they don't always need to be seen as like some kind of, you know, ethical, to use that word again, ethical consideration. It's more just, this isn't how most of the world lives, and it can't be actually how most of the world lives, because there simply isn't enough resources.
There's not enough world to go around.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we're running out of time. Folks, you're listening to Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, and my guest is Ian Morse. He is a scientific journalist, science journalist, and editor of Green Rock, which I highly recommend you're checking out. Is there a website for that, Ian?
Yes, it would just be greenrocks.substack.com.
Okay. And Ian is going to be here with some other folks on Thursday night at a presentation sponsored by the Alliance for Topatika and the whole Vashon Project at Open Space for Arts and Community. Ian, can you quickly tell us about some of the other presenters at this event?
So it is, again, organized by Aalto. So a member of Aalto will be giving a presentation on the kind of resource considerations with electric vehicles, with a specific focus on Sulawesi in Indonesia, but also touching on other sources and other metals. And then an additional guest speaker, in addition to me, is someone who runs a major and respected mining standard. It's one of the most rigorous mining standards in the world, and she happens to live in Port Townsend. Oh. So Amy Bollinger is this other guest speaker, and I'm really excited for her to be there because she has a lot of industry experience and knows how a lot of these things work.
Excellent. This should be very exciting. And folks, if you can't get there, I believe it's going to be recorded, so we'll somehow be made available by somebody on some website, and we'll make sure that you know about it. Ian Morse, thank you so much for joining me here on Real Talk.
Thank you.
It has been a pleasure, and there's so much to this topic. Thank you for telling us about it in Green Rocks and for your reporting.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening, folks. I'm Susan McCabe. I'm here with you every Tuesday at noon on Real Talk 101.5.